This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Today on Keeping the Faith, we're talking about Zen Buddhist practice in China today. It's sort of a notes from a pilgrimage made by Elihu Genmyo Smith, who's our guest today. Welcome, Elihu.
Thank you.
So when did you go to China?
This was at the end of June. We left June 19th and returned July 3rd.
And had you ever been before?
I've never been to China before.
And who organized this trip?
Okay.
Who all went?
Originally, the trip grew out of a discussion between myself and Tonin O'Connor, who's the priest and teacher at the Milwaukee Zen Center. And the two of us talked about this pilgrimage and then contacted a tour group, South Mountain China Tours, that does Chan or Zen tours of China. And so that's how it began. And then we also had another group connected to a group in Chicago led by Taigen Layton, who's a Zen teacher and translator, author of books. So it was primarily people connected to Zen Buddhist practice with people from other groups, from other parts of the country, and people who didn't have any Zen practice or any Buddhist tradition, but were somehow connected either to people in the group or who were interested. A group of about 40 of us, who mostly from the Midwest, but some from the East Coast, some from the West Coast.
Now, you're the director of the Zen Buddhist Center here in Champaign-Urbana.
Yes, the Prairie Zen Center.
Prairie Zen Center. And you've been there how long?
I've been here in Champaign about 10 years. And prior to that, I was connected to the group for about 3 years coming from California when I lived there.
I see. So tell us, what was the purpose of the trip?
Well, it was a pilgrimage. Now, pilgrimage has a long tradition in Buddhism. In one sense, there's really no need for pilgrimage in Buddhist tradition because truly, if one sees the Dharma, so to speak, if one clarifies what the Buddha's teaching is, the Dharma, the nature of reality, then one sees the Buddha and there's no need to go on pilgrimage to places because it's not, doesn't really affect one's practice. Nevertheless, from the very beginning in Buddhist tradition, pilgrimages, travel as a way of devotion, a way of expressing one's practice, as a way of supporting one's practice, was something that began soon after the Buddha's death. There were places connected to the Buddha's life, four places that in India that people would visit, and then other places. And particularly for those of us in the Zen or Chan tradition, there are many sites in China that are connected to ancestors who are significant in the Chan and Zen lineage. Zen and Chan are the same words pronounced in slightly different ways. So in one sense, this is part of our practice because Zen practice is about, in a sense, grasping the mind, the experience of that's being expressed by these ancestors and teachers, expressing the nature of reality, the nature of what the Buddha's awakening enlightenment is. And going to these places was a way of both expressing our appreciation and also living and supporting our practice.
But as I understand your description of pilgrimage in the Buddhist tradition, there's not that sense of obligation that there might be in Islam or in some varieties of Christianity?
I don't know about obligation, yet many people take it on as a religious devotion and practice and also as something that will enable them to deepen their connection with, if we want to use a word, Buddha nature, with their connection with who and what they are. There's also all sorts of ideas about merit and future births, so that one doing this thing, doing the pilgrimage, bowing, doing various religious acts of devotion in, as part of the pilgrimage, enables one to, one's life to further deepen and further develop, and possibly, if we want to say, for future births to be more meritorious.
So tell us a little bit about where you went.
Okay. The group, I mean, we landed in Beijing, and of course we did a few of what you would call the major tourist sites in Beijing. But after that, we primarily went to a Buddhist monastery where we stayed for 3 nights, and to various Buddhist temples or Chan temples connected to ancestors of the Chan tradition. Many of these sites were, we had a bus and we traveled around northern China by bus. And of course, we could only see a little piece of China and a little piece of Buddhism in China. Many of the sites we went to were temples that were just being rebuilt. They had suffered major damage after the Chinese Revolution, and then all the more during the Cultural Revolution. So many of them were just being rebuilt. Some weren't even rebuilt at all yet. We went to some sites where there was a foundation and remnants of the old temple, but there wasn't a new temple yet. The nature of Buddhism in China is that it's essentially controlled by the government, and the government and governmental societies and associations are determine who can rebuild and how much you can rebuild. So all of that is limited. But there are still some sites, whether we call stupas, which are S-T-U-P-A, which are reliquaries, where relics of an ancestor would be, and various other sites that are of significance, both for Buddhist practitioners in the West, but also for Chinese. So the Chinese people come and do pilgrimage to these places as well. In fact, in many sites that we went to, many monasteries and temples, we were the only Westerners that were there.
Remind us how long the Buddhist tradition is in China.
Okay. The Buddhist tradition in China dates from, I believe, the 2nd century of the Common Era. So it's got a long, venerable tradition. Buddhism, in the form of Chan Buddhism, you can say began in somewhere in the 6th century. In fact, one of the places, several of the places we went to were connected to Bodhidharma, who's considered the first ancestor of Chan and Buddhism and Zen Buddhism in China. He's also often connected with various martial arts in China. And since then, Buddhism flourished, and Chan Buddhism particularly flourished in China from about the year 600 to the present, but its heyday was, you might say, 600 to about 1200, 1300 Common Era. So it's an extensive history.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Elihu Genmyo Smith from the Prairie Zen Center, who recently returned from a pilgrimage to China and visited various Buddhist sites. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, but I'm eager to have other listeners call in with comments or questions for our guest today. If you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, where this program originates, do use the phone number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you may use a toll-free number if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. Elihu, as you and this group of 40 folks were traveling by bus around this section of China, were there religious observances within the Zen Buddhist tradition that you all did together?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Let me begin by speaking a little bit about our stay at the monastery, which was the most extended stay. This is, we were there 3 nights, and we participated in some of the activities with the monks and the lay people who lived at the monastery or came to visit, and we also had some activities of our own. We met with the abbot, who speaks English quite well, which was, he took some time out of his very busy schedule. This monastery is known as Bailin Su or Bailin Monastery, and it's connected to two very seminal figures in Chan Buddhism, one known as Chaocho, or in Sino-Japanese is known as Joshu. There are many koans and other stories connected with him. And another figure connected with this particular monastery is Wumen, or Mumon, who put together a significant collection of koans that's known as the Gateless Gate or the Mumon Khan, which I would say is probably the most famous collection of koans in the Zen and Chan tradition. So both of these people are connected to this particular monastery. And the monastery itself was destroyed for the most part during the Cultural Revolution. The monks who had been there, the few monks that had survived after the Communist Revolution in 49-50, they were dispersed, and almost everything was destroyed except for the central stupa, which housed the relics of Chaocho. But it's since the late 80s, early 90s, the monastery is being rebuilt, and it's quite a large monastery now. There are about 100 plus monks living there, and many lay people, and it's open during the day. The monastery gates are open, and many, many Chinese come to visit. And in a way, it serves as a public space for Chinese. And it's very interesting to see how Chinese people see the monasteries and temples as their public space, which means that they both come for religious purposes, but also for various social purposes, which is a connection that in the West we don't quite see in terms of religious spaces being used as a public space in that way. At least I don't see it.
Although within Christianity in this country, there's the history of the church socials that might some similarities perhaps. But tell us, explain a couple words for some of our listeners. Uh-huh. What is a koan?
Okay. A koan or kungan, the Chinese way to pronounce it, is literally it means a public case. It's usually a short several sentences or several paragraphs describing an encounter or a dialogue between a master and a disciple. Sometimes it has at the end of it where the disciple is enlightened by some sort of what went on between them. Often koans are used in the Zen and Chan tradition as a device to enable the students to grasp something of the nature of Zen teaching or Chan teaching, or all the more as a way of grasping the mind of the ancestor that expressed this, what it is that they're saying when they say it. So, for instance, the a number of koans connected to Chow Chow, and I can mention a few of them. There's one which asks, a monk asks Chow Chow, what's the meaning of Zen? Actually, he asks, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? But what that means is, what's the meaning of Zen? And Chow Chow said, the cypress tree in the garden. That's the case. So if one was to practice with this, how does one really grasp how that cypress tree in the garden is an expression of the truth, the whole of what our life is, the whole of the meaning of what Zen is, of the Buddhist awakening? Because that's what the point of that is. And in fact, I bring up that case because in this monastery, they still have, what should I say, descendants of that original cypress tree. That tree isn't there any longer, but there are other cypress trees that are said to be descendants of that.
And the koan in Buddhism is often used as a way to bring the inquirer sort of a new level of awareness, or to move the thought to a different plane.
Well, if you want to say, it's a way to bring together their inquiry, and also to enable them to get an understanding, a glimpse, a taste, an experience for themselves of what this is about, what their life is about. And koans or kungans are particular to the Chan or Zen tradition. Most other Chinese traditions don't use them. So there's another one that's particular. And as I said, this at this monastery there was halls connected to Wumen or Mumon. Again, I'm pronouncing it both in the Chinese way and the Japanese way of pronouncing his name, who lived there and who put together a collection of 48 koans. There's other koans connected to Chow Chow. A monk came and asked for instruction, and Chow Chow said, have you eaten your breakfast? And the monk said, yes. He said, then go wash your bowl. Or another case, someone came and asked for instruction, and Chow Chow said, he said, I'm new here. I come. He says, have a cup of tea. Someone else came, and he said, oh, is this your first time? He says, no, I've been here before. Good. Have a cup of tea. And so the head monk said to him, well, teacher, how come one person is new and you said have a cup of tea, and this other person has been here before and you also said have a cup of tea? And the response was, have a cup of tea. So now, how is this not just an easy phrase, but how is this an expression of the whole of what Buddhist teaching is about? It's a teaching about awakening to what our life is, a teaching that enables one to be liberated from suffering so that one can be truly who one is. So in this monastery, one of the we partook in the morning service with the monks. We were participants. Most of us didn't chant in Chinese, so we were, in one sense, bystanders, but we were able to do bows and be with them. We also had meals with them and then meals separately. And then we had our own hall that they graciously allowed us to use, a hall that they have lay people sit in, and we did zazen or sitting Zen practice in that hall for several hours each day.
Let me follow up a little bit on a phrase you used, be mm-hmm. liberated from suffering. Since mm-hmm. this is a central teaching insight of Buddhism and of Zen, tell us a little bit more about that. What is the goal?
Well, in a way, to say there's a goal is a little bit off, but I'll say it anyway. Provisionally, you could say the goal of practice is to illuminate the mind, illuminate who and what we are, and to realize our true nature. Realizing our true nature, we are free of those call them delusions, those body-mind habits that result in suffering, that result in all sorts of activities that we do which harm us and harm others, and enables us to function in a compassionate way towards others by manifesting the wisdom that is who and what we truly are, which is, quote, our true nature, if I use such fancy words. Now, suffering is very simple. We all know about suffering, and we know it when we're upset about something, when we're distressed about circumstances, about what people say to us, about what happens in our life. So, we use a shorthand. We call it birth and death.
So, would a Zen Buddhist participate in a workers' strike, whether it's in China or this country, to improve conditions that are causing sufferings among the workers? Or does a true Zen Buddhist who's reached this enlightenment think that that doesn't matter?
There isn't, quote, that doesn't matter. There is a question of seeing, is this appropriate activity? Is this skillful activity? But the skillful in the sense that, is this, if you want to say a strike, is this strike an appropriate way that would improve conditions and not generate more greed, anger, violence? Those might be the choices. Now, the other side is to see, does suffering come from the conditions, or does suffering come from our attachments and beliefs about the conditions? If we can see where suffering comes from, then we can act appropriately to the circumstances, knowing that the suffering isn't in the conditions, but the suffering is in how we are in the midst of all sorts of conditions. Then we might, if we're in a union, we might strike. If we're a manager, we might see, how do I negotiate in a way that's appropriate so to make the best circumstance for both the workers and the managers, or could be anything else. I don't want to preclude any particular position, because everyone can practice, no matter what position you are, because the practice has to do with how do we live our life most fully.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking with Elihu Genmyo Smith from the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign-Urbana. He recently returned with a group of 40 folks, mainly from the Midwest, from visiting China, looking at some of the Zen Buddhist monasteries there and temples. And we've been talking a little bit about that. If you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment, do give us a call. Anywhere this program is heard, including on the Internet, if you're listening to WILL AM 580 on the website, WILL.UIUC.edu. You may call us anywhere in the continental U.S., 1-800-222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call to Champaign-Urbana, use that number, 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, do use 333-9455 to access several local lines. Elihu, when you were visiting these monasteries and temples, were you asking questions? Were you just sort of reveling in the experience? How did that go?
To the extent that we could, we were, and I was, asking questions. We were also hearing from the people there. We had, our guide was fluent in Chinese and actually knew the abbots at the various temples, so could speak to them. And we got a sense of a little bit where they were, and also we would heard a little bit about what they went through. I mean, we have to remember that Buddhism in China suffered greatly, especially under the Cultural Revolution, and most of the people there were recent. Many of the people who had lived through the Cultural Revolution were no longer at the monasteries. But
We do have a couple callers waiting. Let's go to local line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes. I wonder if you could tell us something about such practical things as how the monks support themselves. My experience in Asia is that there are a number of Buddhist monks who go out with begging bowls. Also, something about what their food is like. And thirdly, if I may, to what extent, what is the age of the monks in the monastery now, and are they recruiting many young Chinese at the present time? I'll listen.
Thank you very much for the questions.
Okay.
How do the monks support themselves?
It's a combination of donations and labor. Most in the Zen tradition, monks work. Working is part of the tradition. In fact, there's a phrase that dates from the, I think, 9th century, which goes, a day of no work is a day of no food. So in Zen tradition and Chan tradition, there's work that one does in the monastery, and that's part of what the monks do. There's also donations. People come to the monastery and give donations. So that's part of how they support themselves. They don't, or let me say differently, I didn't see monks going out in begging rounds in China the way they do in Southeast Asia, which is what you were, which was being referred to. The diet is, in Chinese monastery, is strictly vegetarian. I'd probably say vegan. I can't be 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that it's vegan. That's the Chinese Mahayana tradition. And there was a third question.
About the age of the monks, whether they're recruiting young people.
They are recruiting young people, but there are government restrictions. So I wouldn't say recruiting. There are government rules in China about who can join the monastery, how many people, even whether, as I said, whether the monastery could build buildings. All of this is tightly controlled by the Chinese government, both on the national and local levels. In fact, we went to one monastery where they were waiting for government permission to build anything because everything had been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. And our going there was one way of helping support them in getting this government permission.
We have another caller waiting on line number four, our toll-free line. Go ahead.
I suppose that's me.
Yes.
Okay. I had kind of two grouped questions, or two questions. One is the nature of the transmission of Buddhism to Japan, which I understand occurred through China. If you could speak somewhat to that transition and how Buddhism might have been altered going through China to Japan as opposed to coming from India maybe directly. The other, you made reference to the Mahayana tradition, and as I remember from my studies, there were two basic traditions of Buddhism, the greater vehicle and the lesser vehicle, Mahayana, Hinayana, and I'm wondering whether both were or are present in China. And what is the nature of the distinction between these two schools? So one question is the transmission of Buddhism through China to Japan. The other has to do with the Mahayana, Hinayana, greater and lesser vehicle traditions. If you could clarify that, please. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Okay. Both of those questions deserve many hours of discussion, but I will briefly say a few words about each. Buddhism in Japan came to Japan. It began in the 6th century. It flourished. Many streams of Buddhism came from China to Japan, 6th, 7th, 8th century. Zen didn't really take in Japan until the 12th and 13th century. Coming from China, you had two lineages that essentially came, several streams, but two large lineages, what became the Soto lineage and what became the Rinzai lineage, coming to Japan in the 13th century with people like Esai and Dogen, many others. So there would be Japanese monks who would go to China, study in China, and come back to Japan. And then there were some Chinese monks who came. Buddhism was already flourishing in Japan at that time, but Zen Buddhism developed in from the 13th century on in China, in Japan. There was a further transmission of what later became the Obaku school in Japan that came in, I believe, the 15th, 16th century. So the forms that it took and the connections between that, I think that's sort of too extensive to really talk about, except to say that Japan made certain changes, and to a great extent, the lineages that I've studied under in America are all from Japan. And yet, when I come to China, I can feel very much the connection and the similarity, even though there is the specific Japanese aspects of the practice.
And what about
now the Mahayana? Yes. And well, the term Hinayana is a term I wouldn't use in the way you did, because it's a pejorative term. It means lesser or smaller vehicle, and it's used in the same sense that when you use the word Old Testament, it predisposes you to think that smaller vehicle or that Older Testament is inferior to the Mahayana, the greater vehicle, or the Newer Testament. So the more appropriate term would be the Mahayana tradition, and if you want to talk about what is now the Theravadan tradition, which is the only other tradition of Buddhism that's extant, these are different traditions of Buddhism. There are many overlapping aspects, and there are also in the Mahayana traditions emphasis that don't exist in the Theravadan tradition on lay practice, on the connections between the lay and the ordained or the clergy. There's emphasis on bodhisattva practice in a Mahayana tradition. Mahayana tradition is essentially the traditions in Tibet, Mongolia, China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and the rest of Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka and India is Theravadan tradition. Again, to talk more about it would be more than what we could cover, unless there's specific questions to be brought up.
Thank you. We'll now let another caller on line number one talk with our guest, Elihu Smith. Yes, line number one.
I'm interested in your comments, and it's very interesting. And I'm also wondering if you could speak about why the Chinese government is so opposed to religious practices. The second question is, while you were in China, did you have any opportunity to see the Falun Gong or the kinds of things that are happening to them?
Thank you for those questions.
Let me answer the second first. I didn't see anything connected to the Falun Gong while I was in China. In terms of why the Chinese government, I can't speak to the why, but I can speak to the fact that it seems very clear that religion, both Buddhist and others, are seen by the Chinese government as another factor of the life in China that they are allowing to grow now, allowing to develop in ways that during the Cultural Revolution and even before the Cultural Revolution they didn't allow, but they're attempting to control the growth, control the connections. So, for instance, they determine what foreign support can come to help build monasteries, or where the monasteries can expand to, or the number of people who can become monks, what sort of texts can be imported. All of these things are controlled by the Chinese government in various ways, by local governments and province level government and various other governmental organizations. At the same time, they are allowing the development of practice and development of connections between the monasteries and temples and the people, and allowing the monasteries and temple and the Buddhist community to be supported and to support the general public in the various ways that they can, in dealing with difficulties in life, in dealing with the various, what should I say, milestones in life, birth, weddings, death, etc. So the functioning within the society of Buddhism is taking on a more dynamic role than it had 20, 30, 40 years ago.
You're listening to WILL AM 580, a listener-supported radio service of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. We do thank listeners for their support of this and other programs. This program is supported in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. Well, let's do get back to our guest, Elihu Genmyo Smith from the Prairie Zen Center. We have another call waiting on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. I have two questions. One is the role of women. I tuned in sort of late. You may already have covered this issue, but what role do women have? And also, you talked about death and dying. I'm anxious to hear how that tradition differs from ours. And I'll hang up and listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. The first question was about the role of women in Zen Buddhism.
Yes. Unfortunately, we didn't get to visit. There were two nunneries that we were going to visit, and for various reasons, we didn't get to visit them. However, we did see. So we didn't see the monastic practice of women. The monastery that we were at had only monks, male monastics. But we did. There were many lay women who were living at the monastery in other quarters or participating in monastery life. And I was actually quite touched by the depth and sincerity of their religious practice. They participated in certain functions such as the services, the meals. They worked in the various parts of the monastery, running some shops and other areas. But it was even with our limited communication, my limited Chinese, their lack of English, and we did have interpreters, but not all the time. There was a sense of the sincerity of their practice, which came out in their being and their functioning. So I would say that the role of women is very vital and alive, and the practice of women, lay women especially, because that's all I saw, is very alive in the monasteries that I saw. Now, of course, that's just a tiny slice. In the temples and monasteries that I saw, it was just a tiny slice. We were told there's 20,000 plus monasteries in China, 20,000 plus, many of which don't have enough people in it. And there are lots of other temples that aren't allowed to function. So,
now, are there women priests?
There are women nuns. So they're nuns, and they're abbots, or I don't know, the abbesses of the monasteries. We didn't visit any where there were any of these temples where there would be women who were abbesses of the temples or the heads of those temples.
Now, what is your title at the Prairie Zen Center?
Title is reverend or teacher or priest at the at the Prairie Zen Center.
And are there women similar positions? Well, in this country or elsewhere.
The person in charge of the of the Milwaukee Zen Center is a woman, Tonin O'Connor, and she's a priest. Now, in the Zen lineage coming from Japan, you have men and women both being ordained, both being priests, both receiving Dharma transmission, leading and teaching groups. So and in a way, in America, it's even more. There is an equality of function in terms of women, and there isn't, and there's also a mixing of, in a sense, that women and men practice together. In China, they do, but they're segregated. So women and men were in separate parts of the temples, the halls, etc. And even in the dining room, women and men would be seated separately. And this is part of the Chinese Buddhist tradition and the Chinese tradition.
Now, the other question the last caller had was about death and dying, and you had mentioned future births earlier. Tell us about the Zen notions.
In Buddhist tradition and in Chinese Buddhist tradition, there is a view that life and death are part of a cycle. And dying isn't the end, it's just the next step. And then there is birth. We need to be careful that we don't mix this up with the Western notion that there is a soul that goes from, that after death, that there's a soul, something that came from this person and that continues. In Buddhist tradition, there is no soul, there is no fixed self in that sense, but there is life, death, rebirth, if you want to say, or next birth. So that's a very significant part. And part of Buddhist practice in China connects to Amitabha, the Buddha of the West, who says that anyone who calls on him will be assured a rebirth in a Western paradise where it's easy to become enlightened. Now remember, the purpose of Western paradise isn't the paradise, but that it's a place where it's easy to become awakened to who we truly are, whereas in this life, it's more difficult. So that's, but in another sense, in a much more immediate sense, Buddhism is about becoming intimate with our life circumstances so that we can truly go through illness, aging, and even our dying by being fully present as we are, as our life is. And therefore, our death is just death. And it's not anything more than another moment right now of being who we truly are.
So do Buddhists grieve when someone dies?
People grieve as part of one's circumstance. However, if one, overly grieves, often they might be, that might be something for them to work with in their practice to see what added attachment, what's their added belief. In fact, that sometimes people would say, if you're grieving, then you don't truly see what life and death is.
So, distinguish for us, if possible, between the Hindu notion of reincarnation and what you described as the cycle of life that Buddhists talk about.
Well, in the Hindu, I don't want to really claim to put forth the whole Hindu position, but in a sense, the Hindu position has that there is an Atman, there is a self that's part of a greater self, and that this self in you is what is reincarnated life after life. Whereas in Buddhism, though there is rebirth, there isn't any self that is reincarnated. So one has to, but again, this is a subtle point, and it's not a matter of words, because in a way one can ask, wakes up each morning? Is it this? Who was that yesterday that went to sleep? Who are you right now?
Are you the same person at 45 you were at 15?
Or even more significantly, who are you right now? 45, 15, 60, no matter what. Who are you? And that's always our practice. In fact, that's a significant koan in the Zen and Chan tradition is, who is it that comes right here?
When the last caller was asking about death and dying, I was wondering what some of the actual practices are when a Zen Buddhist dies.
There are a number of things, and the monastery and temples and priests function in part to be able to support people in dying, in death, in funeral services, in memorial services. In the Buddhist tradition, it says that after one dies, there's various services and traditions to be followed to enable one to make the rite of passage until what's next. But also it's said that one is reborn often within 49 days. But that's just beliefs to feed us. But it is a significant role that the monasteries and temples play for the people to deal with this major aspect of life.
How is a birth celebrated in Zen Buddhism?
Well, in America, there's rites of passage that are primarily American. I won't say they come from Japan or China because it's different in Japan and China. But in America, there are ceremonies similar to what you might have in other Western traditions of welcoming the child, of acknowledging the significance of what being born is, and the child's role in the family and the family's role with the child as part of their practice life. So there's various ceremonies and activities that, depending upon the nature of the community, will occur.
We're talking with Eliu Smith from the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign-Urbana about a recent pilgrimage that he and 39 other folks took to China to study Zen Buddhist practice there. Eliu, one of the sometimes heard issues is that Zen Buddhism, in its way of development in the West, particularly in America and Europe, has its relatively short history varies a lot from what it previously was in China and India and Japan. Is that in this trip to China, did you think that was the case?
In form, things look different, just in part because the Chinese temples look different. But in many ways, it was very similar. Our sitting practice, though the form of how we do it might be slightly different, we can sit in their community, we could bow, and we could do services with them, though we would pronounce our chants would be slightly different. We circumambulated the stupas, and there was a familiarity meaning we share a family connection, even though there are significant differences both in terms of language, in terms of outlook as people, just as Chinese people and American people are very different in terms of past experiences. There's also, we don't have the depth and length of history that they have. Even with all the recent turmoil, they have hundreds and thousands of years, and you could feel that when you're there. When you go to places where they spent somewhere around the year 600 to around the year 1600 carving sutra texts into large stone tablets and then burying them so that these texts wouldn't get lost. So to think of that they spent 1,000 years continuing with this project. We don't have projects that go on even for hundreds of years, even for 20, 30 years is a big deal now. So there's a depth, and yet there's a connectedness that we felt. And I think that's one of the things that most of the people on this pilgrimage felt is the renewal of their connectedness with the Chinese tradition and the people there who, in a sense, reflect this. So even though there were great barriers in terms of language, in terms of other things, there was also connection.
And what were the differences? I'm just guessing here, and correct me if I'm wrong, that most of the people who went on this pilgrimage from the Midwest part of the U.S. were converts to Buddhism. Is there a great difference when you encountered people whose families had been Buddhist for generations?
Well, I don't know if that was the difference. In fact, in China, I think people have to make a conscious decision, or don't have to, but often do make a conscious decision to identify themselves as Buddhist, especially now. So we would hear some people who said, well, my parents are Buddhist, but I'm not, or my parents weren't, but I am. So, but on the other hand, Buddhism is a big part of Chinese history and culture, and these places have deep roots in the Chinese psyche. And it's something that it's hard for us to appreciate in that we don't have a civilization that's been rooted into a place for thousands of years, even though it goes through all sorts of upheavals and changes. And that's, you get a little sense of that in China, or at least we got a little sense. I got a little sense of that. And a sense of these ancestors who were at these various places, Linji, Chaozhou, Weika, Bodhidharma, some of these other ancestors in the Chan and Zen tradition, that this is where they were, this is where they did, this is where their relics, their remnants, what's left of their body after it was cremated are. So there is that there, and you actually, there is something there.
We're down to our last 90 seconds or so, but one last question. What's the relation of Zen Buddhism to other religions?
The relation is that we're all human, and it's all about being, sharing this humanness that we all have. This one of my teachers used to say, we all share this nose hole society. So Zen is about being intimate, being who we are. Who we are isn't dependent on names that we call it, Buddhist or anything else. It's being who we are.
Is there tolerance of other religious traditions?
The theme at this monastery, Bailin Monastery, that we stayed at in last year's summer camp, they had T-shirts which had a theme that said, live in a tolerant world. So, wonderful theme.
Is there a koan about that?
none that comes to mind right now.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Elihu Genmyo Smith. Sensei Smith is the priest and director of the Prairie Zen Center. Give us the address.
It's, the website is www.prairiezen.org. The address is 515 South Prospect in Champaign. The phone number is 355-8835 in
Area code 217.
Area code 217.
And your sittings are scheduled?
The best time for someone who's never been is to come on Sunday. We have an orientation at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. We have services at 9 and then sitting practice on Sunday till 11 and then a talk at 11 and then tea afterwards. And it's open to the public, free, and come and drop by and visit us.
We've been talking with Elihu about a recent pilgrimage to China to explore various Zen Buddhist monasteries, temples, and holy sites. Thank you for being with us, and thanks to all of our callers. Thanks to Matt Kessler, our technical director here at AM 580 WILL. My name is Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
How far would you go for what you believe? Would you do everything the Bible tells you to? How much of your life are you willing to change? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the strange things that happen when people take their beliefs literally. One thing's for certain, walking the walk takes a lot of guts. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana.
As 2007 draws to a close, we thank you for supporting WILL. There's still time to make a tax-deductible donation now to ensure the public radio, television, and online service you rely on will continue to thrive in 2008. I'm radio station manager Jay Pierce. Help us reach our December 31st fundraising goal of $920,000. Call 217-244-9455 or log on to willpledge.org. Thanks.
If you could only listen to 2 hours of radio the entire year, the Third Coast Festival broadcast is the program for you. Of course, if you never turn your radio off, this is also the program for you. The Third Coast Festival chooses the best audio documentaries from all over the world in its annual competition, and we've put those winners together in a show of unforgettable radio. Tune in to hear the best of the best.
Monday afternoon from 1 to 3 here on WILL Urbana. Join us Monday night at 9 for Garrison Keillor's New Year's Eve special. This program, recorded last year at Nashville's historic Ryman Auditorium, features performances by Randy Newman, Emmylou Harris, Wilco, Old Crow Medicine Show, and many more. It's music, comedy, and many of your Prairie Home Companion favorites, New Year's Eve from 9 to just past midnight, here on AM 580, WILL Urbana.